Yep, and I will, I know my voice often trails off. I'll try to speak up. Is 17-3034 and 3035 U.S. v. Cox and U.S. versus Kettler. Now I see we have two counsel. How were you planning to split that?
With the court's permission, I'll speak to issue one in Mr. Cox's brief, which is the mistake of law defense, and I'll hop off in plenty of time for Mr. Kettler's counsel to address the challenges to the National Firearms Act.
Okay, sounds good. We'll see how that works. Go ahead. It usually doesn't work, but I think it might this time.
I appreciate the court letting us give it a try. Good morning, Your Honors. Again, I'm Paige Nichols. I represent Mr. Cox. And as I said, I'll be addressing the mistake of law defense here this morning. I'm calling this a good faith mistake of law defense because it feels more descriptive to me than entrapment by estoppel, which is kind of the groundwork for the defense, as we discussed in our briefs. And the first thing I want to emphasize is that this is a due process defense. It's not a statutory defense, and it doesn't depend on the statute having any particular mens rea in it. So we are not asking this court to find any kind of mens rea in the National Firearms Act that hasn't already been declared to be there. And in particular, I want to point out that in the PICO case, which is a different kind of case but still a mistake of law case, there was no mens rea in the statute at issue there, and the same as to the Raley case from the U.S. Supreme Court. So I just wanted to emphasize that the government has argued that there's no specific intent required to know that you're required to register under the federal under the National Firearms Act. This court doesn't need to find that in order to recognize this defense, because this is a due process defense again. So one thing also that I want to emphasize is that in many of the government's arguments, they are arguments not so much about whether this defense is cognizable, but whether our clients would win this defense if it were cognizable at their trial. And I'm not sure that I did a great job of distinguishing between those two points in the brief. And so, again, I'm going to direct the court to the PICO case from the United States Supreme Court, where the government said there, this agency, defendant should have known that the regulation they relied on, that was the pollution case, was in conflict with prior statements of the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court said that's actually a trial matter. What we care about here is whether this defense of mistake of law is cognizable. So really all we're asking is for this court to recognize that part of the model penal code that just hasn't come before this court before. It's not exactly the same kind of defense that was recognized by the Supreme Court in Cardiff, Cox, Raley, and PICO, but it's very much related in terms of just fairness and due process. And so, both of those...
Talk about fairness and due process, but what about the policy problem of having states undermine federal law by just passing a statute and thereby giving persons who violate the federal law a defense?
Right. And I can understand...
How do you deal with that?
Yes, that's certainly a concern. That same concern arises in the other types of mistake of law defenses, because in those cases you're relying on individuals who are advising somebody about what the law means, or maybe you're relying on a regulatory agency. But I understand the state versus federal.
Those are agents of the same sovereign.
Right, right. And so first I think we have to I can't give you authority for this, but I think we have to presume the good faith of our state legislatures. But the reason I think this court can create a rule that's quite narrow, as we suggested in our brief, which is that if anybody gets a shot, there's only going to be one person who gets a shot to rely on a state law like the Kansas law before a court says, this is not a defense, which Judge Martin said, and nobody coming down the pike from here on out in Kansas could reasonably rely on the Kansas Act as a defense.
Yes, but the Kansas Act could be amended, and then there we go again.
And then there we go again. But I think it would be hard to envision a cycle of amendments that would be reasonable, or that the legislature is going to sign on to. I mean, what we have here is something like 129 Kansas legislators thought this was going to be an acceptable statute. And I also would just point out that Kansas statute is really unique of any of the statutes I've seen. For instance, even the Montana statute that was struck down by the Montana, by the Ninth Circuit in the civil case, it stated that making and owning local guns wasn't subject to federal law, but it did not go that step further, which the Kansas statute does, and says nobody's going to enforce that law against you. And by the way, it's even going to be a crime for agents to enforce that law against you. So the Kansas statute is, I think, an outlier of what legislatures will do. And I think that this court's guidance about what legislatures will do will prevent that huge floodgate, which I don't really think is there, because I think, again, that we can usually count on our state legislators, which is why this is a defense that this court should recognize. I'd like to hop off here with the permission of the court and allow counsel to address the National Firearms Act. Thank you.
May it please the court. I represent appellant Jeremy Keller. Jeremy Keller is a disabled combat vet who returned from Southwest Asia. Was a hunter. Was a guy who enjoyed guns. Saw a gun suppressor in a store in a small town in southeast Kansas. Next to it was the Kansas Second Amendment Act. Read it. Thought he was fully within his rights, fully lawful to have that suppressor. Took it and posted a video about it. And then the federal government went after him. This is, even though you've probably seen in the record that the implications to Mr. Keller don't appear on the surface in a criminal case like this to be significant, probation for a year, $100 surcharge. The reality is this has grave implications for Mr. Keller. Mr. Keller is restrained from certain student loans. Mr. Keller is not able to get the type of employment that he would like within the federal system and with many other employers. There are very substantial implications to him, and he would like the court to grant him relief here. I think a good starting point before we get to the NFA is to talk just briefly about suppressors, because there is a misunderstanding amongst many of us, in part because of the kind of cultural presentation we've had through Hollywood about suppressors. They are not silencers. They simply lower the decibels of firearms. They allow them to be fired safely without damage to hearing. If you fire a high-powered rifle, for example, there is such damage to hearing that one shot can create permanent and lasting impact. And these are devices which actually, contrary to the statement of the government, that they're dangerous devices. They're actually devices to encourage safety. And we'll get into how their accessory is protected by the Second Amendment in just a minute. But first I want to talk a little bit about the NFA and how it's not a proper exercise of federal taxing power. The government makes much of Sosinsky and his progeny and the fact that you know, this particular statute, series of statutes, has been upheld by the federal courts for some time, but never has a federal court considered what is currently in modern day the contemporary practice with respect to the NFA. One of the most significant things that has happened in the recent past is 2003, when the ATF was taken out of the Department of Revenue and was transferred over to the Department of Justice. Primarily a law enforcement agency. In fact, we noted in our briefing that when you go to write a check for this supposed $200 tax, you're actually writing it to the ATF. You aren't even writing it to the Department of the Treasury. This is significant in many respects. On the one hand, the child labor tax cases that we've cited, and of course was distinguished by Sosinsky, they state that one of the reasons why in that particular case it was considered that the tax on child labor wasn't really a tax is because of how it was administered. The Secretary of Labor was in part
but
one of the agents.
The most significant thing in that case is the quantity of the tax. There was 10% of gross proceeds. It was a penalty.
That is correct,
and
Your
Honor. That was the main point, wasn't it?
That was certainly one of the points, but also that the court made it very clear that it was concerned about how it was applied. In fact, there's a paragraph that's devoted to how the Department of Labor, the Secretary of Labor, was also charged with implementation. And, of course, the NFIB, too, also the Obamacare decision, where it was determined that, in fact, part of the reason why they believed it was a tax was because it was administered by the Department of the Treasury. The ATF itself, I mean,
But in the Obamacare decision, they referenced this case, did they not?
Indeed.
Favorably.
Indeed.
You're asking us to be rather brave, I think.
Absolutely. Yes, we're upsetting 80 years of precedent. But there have been major changes that have occurred. And that's what we're asking your honors to take a look at. We absolutely realize that this is courageous, but it's also based upon good facts. And we have case law that suggests that when facts change, we should reexamine the constitutionality of certain things. And in this particular case, we're talking about a $200 fee. It's not been changed in 80 years. I mean, the equivalency today is over $3,600. This is not a revenue-generating exercise. You can look at, for example, the enforcement of the ATF and with regard to this particular so-called tax. I mean, the cost is exponentially greater today, and yet we're still basing it on a $200 fee or $200 tax, whatever you want to call it. The fact of the matter is, it's not revenue producing, it's revenue taking. That's what's happening today. And we've even transferred now, again, the collection of the so-called tax to a law enforcement agency that describes its mission as protecting against violent criminals and other criminal type activities instead of gathering actual revenues. It's not revenue generating, it's revenue taking. It's transferred to an agency that does not involve itself, not even under the Department of Treasury anymore. So it does change the way that we approach this.
With respect to the increase in value of $200, so has the increase in income been comparable? So what's the difference?
Well,
we're making more money, so we're paying the...
Right, indeed. And I think that's a fair assessment to look and see how income has actually also changed. But the $200 has remained static. Income has gone up, making it even a more minuscule amount. That's the point that we're making.
You're saying that the $200 when it was initially assessed would be like $3,600 now?
That is correct, Judge.
Cut that back.
And I just have a few minutes left because we want to reserve. I want to transfer over to Murdoch for just a minute and talk a little bit about that. I think that the Heller case... Let's put it this way. The government can't have it both ways. The government can't say this is a tax and a fee. If it is a tax, then, of course, under Murdoch, it's a tax on a constitutionally protected activity. And that's what Heller has established, that under the Second Amendment, we have an individual right. And this is a tax according to the government.
Is that argued below?
Okay. So the Second Amendment was argued below. That particular issue was argued. And it's our position that cast ourselves on the discretion of this court. But we believe that, in fact, since the issue is raised, we are able to raise questions concerning that Second Amendment issue here on appeal. And there's some support for that, too, Judge.
How is this a violation of the Second Amendment? The suppressor is not an arm.
The suppressor is defined as a firearm under statute, but more importantly, it's an accessory.
That's not the same thing as being bearing an arm for Second Amendment purposes.
That's correct, Judge. Under Miller, accessories are protected. And then we also have under Azell a case that determined, of course, this is a sister circuit, Seventh Circuit, that determined that even fire ranges are Second Amendment protected activities. And the reason why is because how the Second Amendment is actually crafted, where the court in Heller made it clear that the Second Amendment is also those things that assist you in exercising that right.
It also made it clear, Heller did, that they could be regulated.
Right. Reasonable regulation can occur, but under Murdoch, a tax on a constitutionally protected activity is per se unconstitutional, and that's the point that we're getting to. You first have to find that suppressors are covered. There's no question about that. But then, if you grant the government that this is a viable constitutional tax, then it's an impermissible tax, and we'll reserve.
Well, give us some more time here. We have more questions. I suspect I'm not the only one. All accessories, any accessory you want with a firearm is protected under the Second Amendment, is your view?
Well, I think what Heller says is common use, not dangerous. And that's a paraphrase, obviously. This is clearly not a dangerous instrumentality. There's been debate, obviously, in the briefing regarding whether or not this particular component is in common use.
But it's in common use for self-protection, isn't that right?
Judge Hartz, it's really more in common use for training and making sure that you have proficiency with that Second Amendment right, especially in urban areas where you have ranges. These not only protect hearing for the individuals that are using the firearm, but it's also protecting against noise pollution and the like. The other point that I might make, there was a footnote
Before you get to that point, what do you mean it's in common use for training? I know people use earmuffs to suppress the noise. But you're saying at firing ranges, people generally the weapons are equipped with suppression devices?
There are some areas outside of the United States that actually require them. You aren't going to go to the United States gun range today, except for in certain areas where people have actually paid the fee and have them, where you're going to see a lot of them on the range. There's 1.3 million.
So you are or you're not? You are going to see that?
It depends on the range as to whether or not you're going to see many suppressors on the range. There are 1.3 million that are currently registered, probably a little bit more than that. Actually, that number has gone up significantly over the last several years, several tens of thousands each year. But it is something that's used on gun ranges to protect current OSHA. There's a footnote in our reply brief that relates to the OSHA requirement, or not requirement, but suggestion that when you're on a range, it uses not just the earmuffs, but also suppressor. The combined effect of the earmuffs and the suppressors reduce the noise to such an extent that it does not cause damage to hearing. And one of the things when we talk about common use, too, that is kind of the problematic with this is that when something is first, of course, created that assist, and at different stages of firearms development, you had a number of different things. You had a trigger. You had a bolt action. You had a semi-automatic. You have certain types of sights. But those things that are part and function that are in modern usage today, and I don't think anybody can counter that these are not, are things that should be protected. It does not have a dangerous component to it. It's done for safety. There's no evidence before this court that they're used frequently in crimes. I mean, again, that's kind of out of our culture that we think that. And there's a reference, of course, early on in some case law to that, but there's not any empirical evidence that that, in fact, is the case. And I'll reserve what little remaining time we have.
Let me ask you some more questions. I'm confused about the two defendants, so maybe this doesn't represent your client, but there's an issue about shortened rifles.
That's Cox.
Are you able to respond to that, or do we need to ask Ms. Page?
We did not address the short-barreled rifle issue, and so I would allow. I think Ms. Page should respond to that. My client only dealt with a suppressor. He was only convicted of possession of an unregistered device.
Okay. I guess that's all I have. Nobody else has anything?
No.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
May it please the Court. Elizabeth Dinello for the United States. Good morning. I'd like to start with the threshold question whether the National Firearms Act is a tax statute. Szczynski still controls. The National Firearms Act still operates as a tax statute producing revenue. Not a whole lot, but the Supreme Court has indicated that even a negligible amount is enough. And the Court has never balanced the amount of revenue produced with the administrative costs. The Court has only asked whether the particular statute produces some revenue, and the NFA does that. Now, the changes to the NFA over the years have not so fundamentally transformed the statute that this Court would be free to disregard a holding of the Supreme Court. For example, the transfer of ATF from the Department of Treasury to the Department of Justice did not work any substantive change in how ATF, which was already enforcing the statute, would continue to enforce it. That move itself didn't make any substantive change. Although checks are made out to ATF, the money still gets deposited in the General Treasury. Nor have any of the other changes. For example, the appellants have argued that...
Is that in the record, that the money is just deposited to the Treasury?
It is not a disputed point. I believe it's in one of the appellants' briefs, Your Honor. I believe it may be Kettler's brief. There's a reference to the money being deposited in the U.S. Treasury.
Okay.
The appellants have also argued that changes to the NFA, which have allowed ATF to deny permission, indicate that it's no longer a tax statute. Specifically, they're complaining about Section 5812, and the last sentence of that allows ATF to deny a transfer if that would place the transferee in violation of the law. Well, that was added in 1968 as part of the Gun Control Act. And as we've noted at page 19 in our brief, every court, including this one, since then has continued to view the NFA as a tax statute. Indeed, we are not aware of any case today that suggests the NFA is not a tax statute. What appellants are asking you to do is not just brave, but unprecedented and unjustified. Turning to the second issue raised by Mr. Kettler's attorney, whether the NFA is invalid under Murdoch, well, as he acknowledges, the threshold question for that is whether the Second Amendment is even implicated. And as Judge Seymour earlier suggested, silencers are not arms within the meaning of the Second Amendment, as the Supreme Court has defined that term in Heller. They are not bearable arms used for purposes of offense or defense or to strike at another. They are optional accessories. And in answer to your question, Judge Hartz, about does the Second Amendment extend to all accessories, the answer is no. That's not how the Supreme Court defined arms in Heller. I'd note, for example, that in Miller, the appellants have cottoned onto a particular word, accoutrement, which Miller talked about in discussing a Virginia statute requiring militiamen to bring with them to muster their rifle, ammunition, and certain listed accoutrements, which included a knapsack and a canteen. Now, no one would argue that a knapsack and a canteen are protected under the Second Amendment. They are not arms. Similarly, silencers, whether or not they are accoutrements, whether or not they are accessories, they are simply not arms within the protection of the Second Amendment.
That's an open question, isn't it? You say that as a matter of fact, but if that went to the Supreme Court, we would all wait to see what happened. Wide open.
It has not yet been decided, but it is a question of law that this court, it's presented to this court, whether the items here, silencers, short-barreled rifles, are protected within the Second Amendment. And the threshold question is, are they even arms? Short-barreled rifles, yes, they are arms. But silencers, they are not arms. Yet even if they were, they would not be like short-barreled rifles. They are not protected under the Second Amendment because they are not the type of weapon that is commonly owned for purposes of defense of self and home. As this case illustrates, there's no suggestion that these defendants wanted silencers for defense. Rather, these silencers were marketed and possessed for recreation to make sport shooting, target shooting, more enjoyable.
Well, is that, there's no protection to sport shooting or the way counsel characterized it as training?
If a particular statute or regulation so interfered with the exercise of the right to possess arms for self-defense, in other words, if it denied any opportunity to practice with your weapon, which is essentially what the issue was in Ezell, then there could be a Second Amendment concern. But silencers are not necessary to the operation of any weapon, nor are they necessary for home defense. Now, appellants have suggested for the first time on appeal certain benefits that a silencer might have in the event of a home invasion. Well, that conclusion is hardly clear, given that a homeowner facing off against an intruder might well want the loud report of a gun in order to scare off the intruder and any companions, in order to warn the family to stay away, there's danger present, in order to signal to the family or to neighbors to summon help. But whatever the theoretical benefits of silencers for self-defense, there's simply no indication that they are commonly owned for that purpose. And the statistics, in fact, confirm this. As we've noted in our brief, 900,000 silencers, whether or not on its face that seems like a large amount, given the population as a whole, it's not significant, and particularly not significant given the number of individually owned handguns in this country. Now,
do we have a clear definition of what in common use means? If there are 900,000 of something, I would consider that common. Why is the test comparing that number to the number of firearms?
Two responses, sir. One is 900,000 is not common when measured against the several hundred million handguns in this country, which obviously are not accompanied by silencers. In other words, if the quintessential self-defense weapon, which estimates suggest maybe 300 million, even if it's 100 million, the fact that less than 1% of those firearms are equipped with silencers indicates that they are not commonly used for self-defense. But moreover, and this is my second point, is that the test is not whether a particular weapon is common or in common use. It's whether it's in common use for purposes of self-defense.
For purposes of lawful purpose, I thought.
With all due respect, Judge Phillips, the for lawful purposes, that phrase alone, comes in Heller in a discussion about Miller, where on pages 624, 625 of the opinion, the court reads Miller to hold that the Second Amendment does not protect weapons that are, the Second Amendment does not protect weapons that are not in common use for lawful purposes. That doesn't necessarily prove the converse, that the Second Amendment does protect any weapon that's in common use. And the problem with that converse, reading it more broadly like that, is that it disregards the whole theme of Heller. Throughout the opinion, there is a drumbeat of self-defense, starting at page 592, when the court, having done all the textual analysis, gets to the heading, the meaning of the operative phrase, and the court says at page 592 that the Second Amendment guarantees an individual right to possess and carry weapons in case of confrontation. And that continues throughout the opinion. Pages 593, 94, the court's talking about the English antecedents, and it's talking about defense, a natural right of self-preservation. Page 630, the core lawful purpose of self-defense. Page 635, hearth and home. And
that's what we would expect because of the D.C. law that was being enforced as far as firearms in the home. But that doesn't mean that if you're going elk hunting, it has to be self-defense.
The Supreme Court hasn't addressed that, and the fact that it's focused so heavily on self-defense indicates that is the core, which is what the word used. That is the core of the self-defense right, of the Second Amendment right. And indeed, in Caetano, the concurrence on which appellants rely, Justice Alito found that stun guns are protected, and the reason is that they are commonly owned, widely accepted as a tool of self-defense. It wasn't saying they're commonly owned for any lawful purpose, but indicating that what the Supreme Court is honing in on is this right of self-defense. Now, this isn't to say that there aren't rights ancillary to that. And as I've mentioned, the firing range example, or, for instance, even in Heller itself, you'll recall that what was struck down was not only the D.C. ban on certain kinds of handguns, but also the requirement in the District of Columbia that legal firearms be stored in a way that essentially rendered them inoperable. So even though that operability part itself may not have been part of the Second Amendment, it was ancillary to that core right of self-defense.
Well, once you acknowledge ancillary rights, such as training or firing ranges, then isn't the test going to be a balancing test? Aren't you going to have to decide that, there's some measure of protection here. Is this a reasonable constraint on firing ranges? That if they're going to use silencers, they have to be registered or controlled in some way. Don't we have to get to a balancing test, a reasonableness test of some sort at this point?
Only if you first find that the Second Amendment is implicated in the first place. As this court noted in Reese, there are two prongs.
I want to make sure that I've phrased the question so you'll be responsive to it. When you say only once you've started that the Second Amendment applies in the first place, I thought you'd acknowledge that with respect to firing ranges. So the Second Amendment gives some protection with respect to firing ranges. So that's the starting point. And then are the constraints on silencers reasonable in that context? Now, just want to make sure you know where I'm coming from.
My response is that, as the district court held, silencers are, unlike firing ranges, do not implicate the Second Amendment. Number one, they are not arms. And two, even if they were arms, they do not fall within the scope of the Second Amendment as the Supreme Court has defined that right in Heller, whether a weapon is commonly owned for purposes of defense of self and home. That, as we understand it, is the Heller definition of what arms are protected. Now, if you conclude that silencers are not even arms, you don't even have to get to that point. Because if they're not arms, then there's no question whether or not the Second Amendment would apply. Short-barreled rifles, as I've mentioned, those are arms. And so you do have to, still on the prong one, you still do have to decide, are they protected under the Second Amendment? That one's easier because Miller, the court, held that short-barreled shotguns are not protected. The appellants have not suggested any meaningful distinction for Second Amendment purposes between short-barreled shotguns and short-barreled rifles, nor have they shown today that short-barreled rifles are commonly used for purposes of self-defense. And indeed, the testimony at the trial, page 332, the ATF agent Tierney, who himself owns a short-barreled rifle, as well as two silencers, indicating that it is possible to possess these items. The NFA does not block possession. He testified that the reason he owned the short-barreled rifle was that it's just fun to shoot them. So again, there's no indication that short-barreled rifles, like silencers, are used for purposes of self-defense. Now, with respect briefly to the Murdoch issue, if the court agrees with us that the Second Amendment is not implicated, it does not and should not reach the Murdoch issue. However, if it does, we stand by our argument in the brief that review would be for plain error, although the appellants raised a Second Amendment issue post-verdict in response to this pleading in Kansas. There was no argument about this unconstitutional fee, which really is a novel claim with respect to the Second Amendment. So the district court certainly wasn't on notice that this was something that it needed to decide. But even under any standard of review, there would be no Murdoch error here because, as I've mentioned, the NFA does not ban possession of any weapon. And as Tierney illustrates, it is possible to get them. And what the NFA does is the taxes it imposes is on the manufacture and the transfer of firearms, and Heller specifically upheld regulations on the commercial sale of firearms. Now, finally, on the defense raised by Cox and joined by Kettler with respect to the Kansas statute, due process defense does not lie here. The NFA is clear on its face, and indeed Cox testified he was aware of the NFA. To the extent the Kansas statute created confusion that they even in good faith relied on it, that is not a defense. As this court noted in Hartridge at page 1194, a due process defense is not appropriate if it would unduly undermine the enforcement of a particular statute. And that's exactly what would happen here. Congress has determined that what it defines as NFA firearms should be registered and taxed. To allow an exception for people in Kansas would unduly undermine enforcement of that act. And the district court therefore properly rejected that good faith defense. Does the court have any further questions? If not, I'd ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
May I quickly address the court's question about short-barreled weapons?
Please. And then if I've got rebuttal time left, I'll hand it over to co-counsel. And that is mainly the government is relying on Miller, which did not hold that short-barreled weapons are not or could never be protected by the Second Amendment. What Miller held was that there's no evidence in this case to support a finding that short-barreled weapons are commonly used for militia purposes. So I just ask this court not to find that Miller forecloses the argument about short-barreled weapons because Miller came out that way because the defendant did not put on evidence to support the claim that that kind of weapon would fall within Second Amendment protection. And Heller even points out that the defendant in Miller did not appear in the U.S. Supreme Court or
brief the issue. And so I would just ask the court to look very carefully at that language of Miller and not take it too far. And with respect to Heller and whether the Second Amendment is limited to weapons used for protection of the home, the reason that was the focus in Heller is because that's the focus that the litigants brought to Heller. The question there was whether the Second Amendment protects handguns used or kept for purposes of self-defense. So the holding there is somewhat limited, but if you look at the historical language that Heller walks through, which the government referred to, you will also see plenty of references to weapons that people believed they had a right to maintain and have in their homes for the purpose of hunting and controlling game. And now I'll hand things off if there's more time left.
You can be very brief if you have something to say. Yeah.
I would suggest that the government misreads Heller. I mean, Heller's whole theme was an individual right, and I'll just read two excerpts from it. A well-regulated militia cannot exist unless the people are trained to bearing arms. To bear arms implies something more than mere keeping. It implies the learning to handle and use them in a way that makes those who keep them ready for their efficient use. And that was the point in reaching that individual right, and I think your honors need to consider that in determining whether or not the Second Amendment is intended to reach suppressors or should reach suppressors. Obviously, the Supreme Court's already found on nunchucks, stun guns. There have been other courts we've already covered on the ranges, and also the reference to the knapsacks. That's not just simply a statement that was made about the early militias. I mean, those were things that were required by those folks that were exercising their Second Amendment rights in order to do so effectively. They carried their ammo in the knapsacks. It's all part and parcel of exercising the right, the Second Amendment right. Brief statement on Murdoch. It's not about whether or not the weapons are banned. It's about whether or not a constitutional protected right is taxed. And then finally, with respect to the issue of whether or not the suppressors are in common use, you are correct, Judge. This is not something that has been resolved yet. It's an open question, but I would direct your attention to Heller, where certainly at the time that it was decided, there were virtually no handguns in Washington, D.C. And so, depending on how you look at it, whether you're looking at the specific jurisdiction that's being addressed, a larger view, I think certainly 1.3 million suppressors, the government's number is a little bit dated because they have been increasing, reflects that they're in common use. They're certainly a safe thing. They should be protected by the Second Amendment. We ask that you reverse the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. Counsel are excused. Court is in recess till 9 tomorrow morning.